You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence.
So I'm Dr. Christopher Moran, an associate professor of U.S. national security in the Department of Politics and International Studies at Warwick University, also a guest consultant at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Trevor McCriskin, an associate professor of politics in the same department, Department of Politics and International Studies at Warwick University. Trevor has written extensively on U.S. foreign policy and U.S. politics. He is the author of two large monographs, one, American History and Contemporary Hollywood Film, the second, American Exceptionalism and the Legacy of Vietnam, U.S. Foreign Policy since 1974. He is currently working on a new book manuscript on drones, drone warfare. He's trailered some of his ideas and thoughts on drones in the academic journals Survival and International Affairs. And that's going to be the subject of today's podcast. So welcome, Trevor.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. Let's kick this off with some kind of basic stuff. So what are drones and what are they being used for?
Okay, so drones are a sort of popular name for unmanned aerial vehicles. So these are basically aircraft that are remote controlled and can fly at very high altitudes and are used mostly for reconnaissance. They're used to survey large areas, either to track individuals or to keep an eye on areas that need large-scale surveillance over them. The advantage that they have over manned aircraft is that they can stay in the air much, much longer, and you can have constant surveillance, basically, of individuals who are suspected of any number of things. But what particularly interests me is not so much just the surveillance aspect of drone usage by the Obama administration in the United States, but particularly the weaponized drones that it uses that have been used in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, also in the Libyan conflict, but probably more controversially, and this is where the sort of point of my work is focused upon, in the so-called targeted killing campaign against suspected terrorists, which has been aimed at terrorist suspects in Pakistan, in Yemen, and Somalia, in particular. And so that's using drones to track individuals, and then they have various missiles attached to them that can be launched against targets. And this has proved a very popular, shall we say, way of the Obama administration dealing with the threat of terrorism.
Mm. When did drones start being used? What's the timeline here? What's the chronology? When did they start being used by the Pentagon, the CIA, at the request of policymakers,
right,
and Obama?
So as far back as the 80s, there were drones in existence that were being used for surveillance. The Israelis in particular, I think, were using drones back in that period. But the weaponized drones, the more modern sort of usage of them, really began during the Bush administration. And I think from 2004 onwards, you get drone strikes, so the weaponized versions of drones being used by the Bush administration. Bush had relatively limited use of them throughout his whole presidency, just 40-odd strikes within Pakistan. During the first year of the Obama administration, he used drones more frequently for targeted killings, over 50 strikes in his first year, and then that went up to a high in his second year in office, over 120 strikes just within Pakistan. The numbers have fallen away since then, but it's been a consistent usage, particularly in Pakistan, where the CIA runs the program, and then in other territories, such as Somalia and Yemen, where the Pentagon has control of drone usage. So it's become very much a centerpiece of Obama's counterterrorism policy, and this idea of targeted killing, identifying individuals or small groups of individuals that are suspected of either planning or about to carry out a terrorist activity against a US interest or a US related interest, that this has become a very commonplace aspect of Obama's counterterrorism policy, and one that seems almost to resolve a lot of the questions that were raised about what Bush was doing, particularly in response to the seizure and capture of suspected terrorists and their interrogation. Obama has ended that process largely because obviously there was a lot of controversy around the use of torture methods, CIA renditions, you know, sort of black ops prisons, that sort of thing. Mm. All of that was, by executive order, ended by Obama at the very beginning of his presidency. What he now seems to have in place instead is a policy of identifying individuals that are a threat, tracking them using drone technology, and then in many cases using lethal force to eradicate that threat. But that probably raises all sorts of moral issues, perhaps, that make some people very uncomfortable.
Yeah, can you just unpack for us the advantages? You know, why are drones being increasingly used? I mean, to use the case study of the Obama administration, why is the White House turning more and more and more to drones?
I think what they find attractive about them is their sort of precision, in terms of the cameras that they carry, extremely high resolution, very able to gain a great deal of detail in what they're looking at. They can linger over targets for a very, very long period of time, so that the drone operators, who are largely based back in the United States, are able to see on their video screens very close detail of what individuals are doing, perhaps what they're reading. And so it enables individuals to be tracked and to be watched in ways that would be much more difficult using sort of people on the ground to track them or other technologies that maybe could be used. So it's highly attractive in that respect.
More, is there more watching going on than killing?
There is, I think, more watching going on. What we tend to hear about is when the lethal strikes occur. But drones are being used not just by government, but by a lot of other organisations. The Federal Aviation Authority in the United States, toward the end of last year, issued a very large number of licences to companies to use drones. Some of that is for surveillance. They're sort of, you know, more mobile, obviously, than CCTV. And so they've been used, increasingly being used by sort of private security companies, that sort of thing, and the police are beginning to look at drone technology as well. And there are commercial uses that are being talked about, many of which make people giggle, rather, because the idea that Amazon is experimenting with drones for the delivery of your book packages, and also that Domino's Pizza and I think various other pizza companies are looking at the possibility of, rather than having an individual riding around on a motorbike, that you'll have a drone delivering your pizza to you before too long. So they may become very commonplace in our everyday lives within a few years from now. But that, in some ways, is a little disconcerting, because would we be able to tell the difference between a drone that was just going to deliver you a package versus a drone that was actually
weaponized?
You know, well, maybe watching you, but also potentially weaponized. And it could well be that you know, police forces may end up with weaponized drones. It's just a whole tranche of kind of questions that arise from that, I think. And I think we worry about the technology becoming the driver of what happens in policy rather than the other way around. And there's certainly a lot of fear, probably driven by some of the sort of fictional accounts that we have of what the future might look like. I mean, the Terminator films always come to mind. I think that if the drone technology continues to expand and increase in the way that it has done, and the level of computer controls over what the drone can do, that you know, I think people fear a future where you're going to have something along the lines of Terminator, where the machines take over. That seems quite extreme to think that, and maybe a bit laughable, but if you think of the level of development we've had up to this stage, it's maybe not that far out of the bounds of reality that we may have something like that down the line. You know, at the moment, the US is the country that's using weaponized drones. That's not going to stay the same for too long. You know, other countries are certainly interested in having that same level of technology. And you can see potentially the wars of the future as, you know, being much more remotely fought. Now, one of the attractions of that, for and one of the reasons the Obama administration likes to use drones, is because if you've got an unmanned vehicle going over a very dangerous area, either a city that's occupied by hostile forces, or perhaps, as is often the case in northern Pakistan, into areas that would be very difficult to access on the ground, you're able to get to targets that you would find much more difficult to acquire if you were using other forms of attack. So that makes it attractive, because you can do things that you couldn't necessarily do with conventional forces. But it's also thought of as being attractive because you can single out individuals rather than having your sort of traditional airstrikes, which maybe take out quite large areas and therefore have a lot of collateral damage, potential civilian casualties, etc. The argument for drones, for drone strikes, is that the missiles that are carried on board, coupled with the level of reconnaissance technology, enables very precise strikes to the point where you can just take out a single individual as they walk away from a car, rather than having to take the car out and maybe some other buildings around it or whatever. So that makes it very attractive.
Precision is a common theme here, and obviously that that argument is routinely deployed by the Obama administration, but often that's not what we hear coming out of newspapers and websites from Pakistan. There's a lot of talk of collateral civilian damage. Would you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, there are certainly...
Who's telling the truth?
Well, I mean, see, the CIA and other elements of the Obama administration have claimed that civilian casualties are extremely low, in fact, at zero for quite long periods of time. They argued that there were no civilian casualties. One of the problems we've got is that a lot of these claims are not very easily verified, particularly when they're happening in remote regions, which, as I've pointed out, are quite difficult to access. You have the very official kind of view coming from the United States on the one hand, saying, no, it's very precise and clean, and, you know, we just took out the enemy. Whereas those on the ground are obviously then saying, well, that's not what happened. Look, you know, with the X, Y, Z has happened. But it's quite difficult for independent verification to take place. So there are organisations that are trying to account for the number of drone attacks and to give a fuller account of what level of casualties there might be in terms of civilians in particular. But it's very difficult for them to do that with any kind of level of accuracy that can be verified and accepted as being the case. So, and also, you know, that's complicated further, particularly in Pakistan, by the fact that it is the CIA that's running the operations. And although over the last couple of years, the Obama administration has issued quite a lot of detail of what the Pentagon is doing outside of Pakistan with drones and the targeted killing campaigns in Yemen in particular, What we've not got very much information about is the CIA operation in Pakistan, which was completely denied for a long time and is now acknowledged, but largely secret still. And so it's even harder to verify what's happened there. We tend not to get so many official statements coming out about who has been killed, why they've been killed. There will be anonymous CIA officials who will issue some, you know, we've just hit the number three target or the number four target. But we only have their say for that, obviously. We don't know necessarily whether these individuals really were as high up the scale as is claimed. And some of the research that's been done by think tanks in the US suggests that quite a lot of the people that have been killed by drone attacks have not been particularly high-ranking members of Al-Qaeda or its associated groups, and that you know, this is perhaps quite problematic. There have been a few very high-level leaders who have been killed, and it's been verified on both sides that that's occurred. But the majority of those that are being hit are lower-level operatives, or in some cases just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there's some very interesting accounting that goes on within the Obama administration, within the CIA and the Pentagon, over who has been killed and what role they were playing. And it's thought that if you happen to be a male and you happen to be between the ages of sort of 18 and about 45, and you were in an area where suspected terrorists were operating or were housed, that you were probably in league with them, and therefore you'll get counted not as a civilian casualty, but as a an Al-Qaeda or associated group casualty. This seems an awful lot like some of the accounting that occurred during the Vietnam War, where the kill count was very important to the Nixon administration especially. But it was hard to tell whether somebody was Viet Cong or not. But if they were dead, they were. If they were in a certain place, you know. So I think there are real issues about that, that these sort of death statistics are being used as measures of success. And that the how verifiable those are is really open to question.
You're writing a book on drones, just to follow up on a few things you've been saying. You're writing a book on drones. Where do you get your information from? I mean, presumably, certainly current drone policy would be exempt from freedom of information legislation, and I can't imagine the CIA is willingly declassifying drone material of the recent history.
I mean, there have been some documents have been leaked. A lot of the reliance here has to be on the work of journalists, actually, to try to get material out. But on the other side of it, there has been an increased sort of acknowledgement by the Obama administration that people want to know a bit more. They feel like this is, you know, there has been some quite heavy criticism of the degree of secrecy around the drone campaign. And Obama didn't even mention it for the first few years of his presidency.
Did
Bush? Then only in passing. Bush never really talked about it very much either. And very few people within the administration did. When they did come out with it, it was just to kind of say, yeah, okay, you know, this is happening, but it's highly justifiable and what have you. We've had a lot more come out in the last couple of years, largely in response, I think, to the criticisms, especially in the media, but also from human rights groups like Human Rights Watch. And so there's obviously material that they're publishing. There are various organisations that are holding what you might call drone watches, just to see what's being done and to try to look at media reports, not just in the US but around the world, that claim that strikes have occurred, that try to keep count of the number of times that public officials will let slip that there was a drone attack, or that, you know, a anonymous individual will announce that drones have been used. What they tend to focus on is the targeted killing, because drones are being used a lot, have been used a lot in, as I say, the Afghan war, in the Iraq war, while that's still going on now with the campaign against Islamic State. Drones are part of the weaponry that the United States is utilising. But it's really, it's the targeted killing campaign that is more controversial. and that is the one that's more shrouded in mystery, despite the administration having issued, you know, there have been various speeches given by individuals within the administration, within the CIA, within the Pentagon. Obama himself gave a major speech at the National Defense University in May of last year, where he said that the policy had now been codified, that a presidential policy guidance had been written and signed off by the president, and that he assured us that this meant that there were now processes in place to make sure that targets were properly identified, that they had good evidence that the individuals were responsible for whatever it was that they were being accused of, and that either the country that they were in was unable to capture the individual and bring them to trial or whatever, or they were in a region where it was difficult to gain access, and therefore a drone strike was the best option.
You mentioned that targeted killings are controversial. I mean, the other question that springs immediately into my mind there is, well, are they legal? I mean, sending a drone into another territory, does that not constitute a violation of another country's sovereignty, for example?
Well, the longest document that we have detailing drone policy and the rationale behind it is actually a legal document that was leaked from the Justice Department. And this was a document that was put together when the Obama administration targeted and then killed a Pentagon strike using a drone against Anwar al-Awlaki, who was a US citizen, but an alleged al-Qaeda operative, was thought to be responsible for the attempted bombing of an airliner at the end of 2009 as it approached Detroit around Christmas time. And so this legal document was produced by the Justice Department to give the legal backing to the decision to target and kill this individual, despite him being a US citizen. And there were various aspects of legality that were argued within that document, and so something like a 60-page document that we now have. And so one of the justifications was the authorization to use military force that was put in place by the United States Congress after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, which effectively gives authority to the president to use force against any target that is about to undertake a terrorist campaign against the United States. So al-Qaeda and its operatives, all of its operatives, all of its associated groups are covered by this. So that was the principal piece of law that the attacks were based on. And from that flows the idea that the United States is at war with al-Qaeda, and therefore, wherever it's operating, it's able to do this. What's also argued in there is the point that I made earlier, that if there is either agreement from, whether explicit or tacit agreement from the government of the country in which the drone strike takes place, that obviously could be seen as legitimising it. But there's also the view taken that if the government and the security forces of a country don't have the capacity to act themselves to take out a target, that the United States has the right to intervene and take that target out itself. But it does raise all sorts of questions about sovereignty.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that in Pakistan, for example, there has been quite a lot of public outcry about drone usage against targets that are within Pakistan. But in private, and we know this partly from the documents that were released through the WikiLeaks, that in private, certainly some very high-ranking Pakistani officials have admitted that this is really a good thing, because it's enabling them to deal with the problem that they have, and that they're quite pleased that the US is using this technology to try to eradicate certain threats that they find threatening, as well as the United States.
I guess drones, they seem emblematic to me of a larger shift in the role of the CIA since 9/11 from one of gatherer to hunter. So the traditional role of the CIA is to sit and cogitate quietly on the world's problems, perceive national security threats. But now it's going after terrorists.
Yeah.
And what I would put to you is, well, is taking people out necessarily the right thing for an intelligence agency to be doing? Wouldn't it be better to, for example, watch these people, leave them in their communities, see who they mingle with, see who they meet with? Would it not be better to maybe send in a team to capture a potential terrorist, to interrogate him, extract more intelligence?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the major criticisms of the targeted killing campaign, is that you might eradicate a threat, but you may also eradicate with that any opportunity to discover intelligence that could lead to further sort of exposing of individuals that are part of Al-Qaeda or one of its associated groups, or other plots that are being planned. So it does seem in that respect to be almost a counterproductive approach. But as I suggested earlier, I think that's partly a result of the difficulties that arose from the way that the CIA was operating prior to Obama coming into office, and the very strong criticisms of the kind of enhanced interrogation techniques that were being used, the rendition program, that these were seen as not being in keeping with the sort of values and principles that the United States is promoting internationally. And Obama was very clear on taking office, and actually the second day in office signed an executive order to end those techniques and those operations by the CIA, and they were very quickly put in place. He also, of course, tried to close the Guantanamo detention center, and that's proved much more difficult for political reasons, mostly because many members of Congress don't want these individuals moving, say, to the United States, to some facility in the US itself. They're quite happy to have them offshore. So there have been a lot of difficulties with doing that, and they can't simply be released because, you know, even if they weren't radicalised back in 2001, they probably are now. So he's really had problems with that. All of this kind of leads to a point where, and I've talked with various people at Human Rights Watch about this, that the sense that capturing is not really a very attractive proposition anymore because it's associated with too many political problems. What do you do with the individual if you do capture them? Do you just hand them over to foreign authorities? Well, if you do that, you're more or less losing, you could be losing the information anyway, unless you have a very close relationship with them. If you capture them, where
put
do you take
secret prisons?
You put them in secret prison. Well, you can't anymore because there is no secret prisons anymore because they've all been closed down, we're told. So, you know, there are difficulties now with capture that maybe weren't there during the Bush years. And so the next step from that then is, well, if you can't capture them, or it's difficult to capture them, and it may be difficult because of where they are and also the sort of cost evaluation. I mean, another reason why drones are so attractive is that they seem to diminish the cost to the US. Yeah. Almost completely. I mean, they cost a lot of money to buy and to run, but you're not likely to get very many casualties on your side as a result of the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, because the drone operators are thousands of miles away in the United States, and the there are technical teams in the region, but they're again very removed from the areas where the drones are actually operating. So you completely minimise casualties on your side, which is obviously seen as very beneficial in terms of public support for this, and they are very popular.
Yeah, you don't want headstones in Arlington, do you?
Exactly. You know, it does mean that they are more likely, it seems, to be used than not. But the consequence of that is you do end up losing information. You do end up killing people instead of capturing them. The administration officially says that it has a kill or capture policy, but it does feel an awful lot like a kill, not capture policy in reality. There are very, very few Al-Qaeda suspects who have been captured during the Obama administration. Far more have been killed.
Does your research support the thesis that Obama's drone policy has been a success, however you measure success, which is obviously very difficult. Is that the line that you would push in your book?
I think it's very much open to debate whether you would conclude it's been successful or not. And I think it's interesting the way actually that the Obama administration has even talked about that success. So within the same speech, Obama and also Brennan, head of the CIA now, who worked on the drones campaign a lot while he was in the White House, have made claims to the great success of the targeted killing campaign, that it's taken out very many influential leaders of Al-Qaeda and various associated groups of Al-Qaeda, that it's broken their ability to have successful plots against US targets or allied targets. And you could argue, I suppose, that the fact that the overall number of uses of targeted killing has reduced over time, that's a measure as well, that they have been successful because they don't need to do them as often now. There haven't been major attacks on US soil for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Where there have been threats identified, like in Yemen last year when diplomats were removed because there was a fear of imminent attack, the number of drone strikes within Yemen went up considerably in that short period afterwards, and then the alert was taken off and those officials came back. So again, that looked like a great success. You use drones to end a terrorist threat. But in those very same speeches where they're celebrating how successful these strikes have been, they're also then saying, but this is still a very dangerous enemy. We still have, the leadership is still there, the nature of it is the kind of, take off one head, another head rises up. So one of the major themes in my work is that what we're seeing here through this technology, because it is so attractive, because there's almost a sort of seductive nature to the technology, the belief that it's very clean, that it's very effective, that it minimises casualties on your side, that only the bad guys get hit on the other side, and that it almost seems to have limitless possibilities as to how you can utilise this technology, means that this idea that's been around for quite a long time, but it seems even more likely now that this war against terrorism is turning into a real perpetual war. It's turning into a war that will go on and on and on, that there's almost no end to it, because it's costless. It appears costless to the policymakers, to the American public. Public support for the use of drones for targeted killing is between about 65% to 70% in the United States. Quite the reverse outside of the United States, where particularly in the areas that are on the receiving end, far less popular. But it's there are not that many people saying we need to take control of this, we need to end this. I guess what I'm hoping to do with my work is to raise questions about that, really challenge that notion that this is such a clean, effective way of dealing with the problem of terrorism, or whether it actually releases far more problems than it ends up resolving. And maybe also to think about what does happen further down the line as more and more states start using drone technology, when they get weaponized. And non-state actors as well, absolutely.
Is there any evidence to suggest that drones and drone technology is falling into the hands of folks who the United States wouldn't want this technology
other states have started using drone technology, and China, I think, has a drone program. I think the Iranians made a big deal of having shot down a reconnaissance drone over Iran. It's inevitable that this technology will spread, and it will spread probably quite rapidly. And that's where there are some concerns that maybe there needs to be some form of international controls over the development of these weapons. And that is complicated by the fact that they have non-weaponized commercial uses, you know, drones is a big catch-all term, really. Mm. For a lot of different technology that's being used in this way. You can go to your you know, your local kind of shopping mall, and gadget stores will have individual drones that you can buy as a Christmas present, fly around your neighbourhood. It's got a little camera on it, goes back to your smartphone.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw it the weekend at the Etihad football stadium in a match between Manchester City and Tottenham Hotspur. A man was actually arrested.
Yeah,
he was bailed. He's got a court appearance in, I think, a few weeks. But he was arrested for flying a drone over the football pitch. Yeah. And he was arrested on the grounds that if that drone failed, and it fell to the ground, poor Sergio Aguero, one of the best footballers in the world, would be... incapacitated.
Yeah. Well, actually, even a couple of weeks previously from that, there was a European Championship qualifier game between Albania and Serbia, where some Albanian fans flew, again, a non-weaponized, obviously, drone across the field that had a Greater Albania flag dangling from it. This was ripped down by one of the Serbian players. Massive fight broke out. Yeah, drones are becoming part of our everyday experience, as I said earlier on. And some of that will end up being quite positive. Some of it is quite troubling, really.
And maybe that's where we can conclude. I mean, where is this all going to end? I mean, are we going to wake up in 10 years' time, pull open our curtains, and just see a fleet, an armada of drones policing our skies?
It's entirely possible. I saw a wonderful cartoon recently of a kind of standard suburban home, and there were, you know, various drones flying around this home, delivering pizzas, delivering books, bringing the kids' homework to them because they've been off school sick. You know, all of these possible things that they could be used for. And then down in the corner is the radio's on, and there's a report of, you know, six people being killed by a drone in Yemen. And it's sort of what I read that as meaning is that the more normalised drone technology becomes in our everyday lives, actually the more likely that they'll be used for violent purposes in the foreign policy of the United States and potentially other countries as well, because we'll become even less concerned about them. At the moment, drones are still quite an unusual technology. We don't really understand them, we don't really know what they are, and we give all sorts of meanings to them that are still quite mystified. If they become demystified, in some ways you might think that's quite a good thing, because at least we'd be more aware of what their capabilities are. But if they become very commonplace, then perhaps we just won't think about the fact that, you know, we'll think of drones as things that bring you pizzas rather than things that bring death and destruction to people in other places far, far away that we don't need to worry about. So that, again, I think contributes to this notion that this technology is enabling war in ways that maybe other technologies in the past have attempted to do, but never quite got to the point that this may be capable of doing. So that's why I'm quite fascinated by them, and think that they're worthy of more investigation and more understanding. And some of that really is quite abstract, I think, to really think about what meanings are we giving to drones. Not so much what they actually are and what they can do, but what we conceive of drones as doing and being capable of doing. And that if publics are doing that, and if elites are doing that, that contributes to the way that they then get used as deliverers of policy, effectively. And again, I think we need to be far more cognizant of that than we are at the moment. Otherwise, the future could look pretty scary, actually.
A dystopian.
Yeah.
Well, clearly you're making hay while the sun shines. Dr. Trevor McCriskin, thank you ever so much. And we look forward to your book. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we will see you next month.